Today on our premiere episode, Justine tries to explain a cricket stump up someone's ass from Garrick Jones' new novel, and Michael Kraft joins us to talk about Choirmaster and a talking cat, or does he talk?
Welcome to Gay Mystery Authors with Brad Shreve, featuring interviews with some of the most renowned authors and up-and-coming talent in LGBTQ mysteries, suspense, and thrillers. Plus, Justine Adamek is here with her weekly recommendation.
Okay, Justine, I know I'm supposed to keep my cool. Everything's supposed to just kind of smooth and easy, but I'm really excited. This is our first one.
Yeah, kind of the first time on the real live tracks. Let's give it a go and see how we do.
Well, then let's just get started. I want to hear what you're going to talk about today.
Well, I'm going to talk about The Cricketer's Arms by Garrick Jones. I'm going to give you an overview review of that book. And before I get to that, I'm going to let you know about Requeered Tales, which I am one of the partners in. We're bringing back gay fiction one book at a time. So what we do is we get old books that are out of print from anywhere between Stonewall and the turn of the century, and we reproduce them on ebooks and occasionally in print. On September 27th, we released Banged Up by Jack Dixon. And I don't know if you've read the first book, Freeform. It's a pretty powerful catalyst, very gritty, really in your face with the sex and the violence, but it's not gratuitous at all. And the dialogue is written in Scottish dialect phonetically.
I haven't read it yet. I've been trying to get caught up on current writers, which is quite the challenge because there's so many.
Yeah.
but I've got a long list of these are the ones I got to get around to, and yeah, it's on my list.
I think you'll like it quite a bit. It's very different from anything I have seen on the market.
I love gritty.
It is certainly gritty. So how about we get to Garrick Jones and Cricketer's Arms?
I'm excited about this. I haven't read Cricketer's Arms. I read his book, The Boys of Ballaroo. It's not a mystery novel. It was beautifully written. I'm going to even admit it made me cry a couple of times, which was kind of what it was supposed to do.
Right.
It was so excellent. I'm really excited to hear how he did as a mystery.
I think this is his first mystery. Is that correct?
As far as I understand, I think it is.
Good. I got to say, especially for his first time out, he's got the same beautiful writing of his other books, but he's really mastered the whole mystery pacing. It's got a good central mystery, and it's got various clues peppered throughout. So I enjoyed it quite a bit. Now, it's a long book. In paperback, it's 404 pages. So if you're like me, and once you open a book, you can't stop until it's finished, well, you might not want to start too late in the evening.
Oh, you're one of those.
Yeah, I'm one of those. I bet a lot of people who are listening to this are one of those too.
Yeah, I'm always impressed with that because I'm a slow reader, and I talk to folks like you who say, I listen to all these podcasts, I watch all these TV shows, I read all these books, and I'm like, how the hell do you do that?
Well, you know, sometimes the laundry has to just build up.
Well, it's good to hear that it kept you engrossed enough to read it all the way through. What more can you tell us about it?
Well, let's see. You know, the murder mystery is rather gruesome. They find a top cricketer pegged to on the cricket pitch, pegged to four posts with a cricket stump, which I believe is a bat, or it may be the stump that the pitcher on the pitcher's mound, but a cricket stump wedged up his arse. You know, there are a lot of, it's set in Australia in 1956, and there are a lot of Australian phrases that I had to look up. For example, sly grogger. Have you ever heard of a sly grogger?
No, I haven't.
Apparently, it's someone who sells illegal booze after hours.
Well, this is going to be kind of fun to learn a lot of this new stuff.
Yeah, it is kind of fun. It is kind of fun. But as I'm sitting here talking to you, I realize maybe a cricket stump isn't the bat. Maybe it's the post.
Either way, it doesn't sound like something you want stuck up your ass.
That's correct. And then so you've got that gruesome death. And then you find out that Clyde Smith, the main character, was a POW in Italy during the war, and it's peppered with his remembrances. And you would think that this is a gritty book, but it's not. It's, you know, the main character is rather genteel. You know, he learned to cook in Italy during that time. And every morning he goes out to the fresh markets and gets, you know, what fruit is available in the 1950s and comes back and cooks meals for his on and off again lover. And he's overall a good guy.
Now, does he go much into the past as far as being a POW and that sort of thing?
Yeah, he does go into the past. It's generally okay in existence where he just kind of got through the days. There are times when he sees people being killed and ends up killing one.
Let's see, this is kind of exciting for me because anybody that knows Garrick Jones, he is a master at research. He knows his stuff when he's talking about history. So I would guess all the events that take place in the 50s are right on target.
Yeah, the 50s is exactly right. And I was surprised at the amount of detail that went into an Italian PO war camp, which basically, you know, it's in his background and provides a good plank to build this character on, but really doesn't have anything to do with the plot at hand. And I thought that was an attention to detail and a layering that, one, not only justified the 400 pages, but showed what a great writer he is and how this is, while the blurb described it as pulp fiction, it's not really a pulp fiction. It's more of a literary work, which reads like a pulp fiction.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like pulp fiction.
It's got a pulp fiction kind of plot. I think that's a good way to put it. Pulp fiction kind of plot, pulp fiction kind of characters, but the writing is a step above.
So he goes deep into the main character?
Goes very deep into the main character. And what's interesting is that he's also, you know, every now and then he kind of scatters through the thoughts on relationships. And as he gets deeper into the book, he really fleshes that out in a way that it doesn't take away from the story. And you know, at the beginning, the main character, Clyde, wants to settle down with his on and off boyfriend. But the on and off boyfriend's in the closet and has a fiance for show mostly. Although he tries to pretend even to her that he's straight.
Oh, it was the 1950s.
It was the 1950s, but, you know, Clyde is out, and I think he suffered the consequences on the police force, and now he's an ex-police officer.
Interesting.
It is. And so what happens is, you know, he's got this on and off again boyfriend, and you can certainly tell from their interactions that they love each other, but, you know, they have relationships on the side, so he runs along having a variety of liaisons. I think once he actually had three in one day. And he said at his age, that was getting to be a little difficult.
Well, I say good for him.
Good for him.
You know, my Kindle is bursting at the seams, and this is one of them that's in there. So I'm going to have to move it up the list a little bit, it sounds like.
Yeah, no, I think you really are going to have to do that. You better do it before the next Clyde Smith book comes out. I'm really hoping he brings another book out with this guy. And I think he will, because the title is A Clyde Smith Mystery. And why would you say A Clyde Smith Mystery if you weren't planning to have more?
Sounds to me like there's going to be more. And if it's that good, I look forward to it.
Yeah, I think it's great. I think it's one of my favorite new books at this point.
Good to hear. So I'm going to take this as a glowing recommendation on your part.
That's right. I think we should start ranking recommendations, and this one is glowing.
Glowing. Is that? Are we going to have? Are you going to come up with a list of ranks? 1, 2, 3, oh, yeah. 4, 5 is kind of overdone. So
yeah, I know, but because generally, if I review a book, you know, it's one of my fives. You know, I read a lot of books, and while it looks like I have a fives, there's a lot of below fives. So I'm thinking glowing is a ranking, and that's one kind of five. Flaming will be another ranking. That's one kind of five. And touching will be another kind of five. I'll come up with a list for you.
That sounds like a good start.
Okay, so you ready to go with the first show?
I'm absolutely ready to go for the first show.
Good luck.
Thank you so much, and we'll see you next week.
Interact with other crime fiction fans and authors in our Gay Mystery Thriller Suspense Fiction Group on Facebook. Links are on our website, gaymysteryauthors.com.
Michael Kraft, I have got to say, it is a pleasure to have you on here today. Welcome.
Thank you, Brad. It's a pleasure to be here, especially on your inaugural podcast. This is great.
Well, I was going to say, it's a red letter day for both of us.
Right.
This is the first podcast. And for you, what is going on today?
It is publication day for Choirmaster, Mr. Puss, Mystery Number 2.
The second Mr. Puss. What a great day. For those that know Michael Kraft is an author of 16 novels, including the acclaimed Mark Manning mystery series, from which three installments were honored as finalists for Lambda Literary Awards: Name Games, which came out in 2000, Boy Toy in 2001, and Hotspot in 2002. In addition, he is the author of two produced plays, and his prize-winning short fiction has appeared in British as well as American literary journals. Michael grew up in Illinois and spent his middle years in Wisconsin, which inspired the fictitious setting of his current books, which we're going to talk a little bit about. He holds an MFA in creative writing from Antioch University, Los Angeles, and he currently lives up in the beautiful desert in Rancho Mirage, California.
And it's a beautiful day. I mean, summer has ended. That's the main thing. So we're ready for fall here. And
you guys wait for that all summer long. Can't wait for it to cool off a little bit.
Count the days.
I'll tell you, here in LA, we can see a blue sky. So that's very nice. I'm going to start out. I normally don't like asking where do ideas come from, because it's really hard question for an author to answer, because sometimes we have no idea. But
you're going to stick me with that question anyway.
I have to ask. This is a gay mystery with an elderly widow with a talking cat.
Sort of.
So where did this come from?
Well, it was sort of a twisted path. I can give you a specific moment, though, when the germ of the idea was planted. This was 4 or 5 years ago, and I was reading a New York Times column by Maureen Dowd, and she made passing reference to Tobermory, a talking cat that appeared, I think, in a 1911 short story by the author known as Saki, S-A-K-I. Well, this kind of piqued my curiosity, because I was not familiar either with the author or with the talking cat. So I found the story and read it and was thoroughly intrigued by it. And then this brought to mind a conversation I had had some years prior to that with my agent. And he knew I liked cats and suggested that I might look into cat mysteries. Now, at the time, I didn't even know they existed. I didn't know cat mysteries were a thing. But one thing led to another, and the result was Mr. Puss. It started as a short story that I entered in a contest here in Palm Springs with the Palm Springs Writers Guild for their annual fiction contest, and it took first prize, and everyone seemed sort of enchanted by the idea. That's when I introduced the cat as belonging to the wealthy widow, Mary Questman. And I just, you know, there was enough excitement about that story that I thought, you know what, I think I can work with this. I think I can, you know, not only stretch it into a novel, but this sounds like possibly the basis of a series. And I knew just instinctively that it was time to go back to my roots as a gay mystery writer. So I connected. You know, the widow and her cat, which we don't know if he actually talks, but he certainly seems to make himself able to communicate with people who he chooses to communicate with. And I sort of dovetailed this into the concept of using a character I had developed in an earlier collection of short stories, Brody Norris, who becomes he's a gay architect, and he becomes sort of a sidekick to the local sheriff, helping him, you know, solve mysterious deaths there in the idyllic little town of Dumont, which I had written a lot about before.
I was going to ask you about Dumont, because it's the same setting as your Mark Manning series, correct?
Right. Dumont appears in the third Mark Manning book, Body Language. The first two Mark Manning mysteries, there are seven altogether, were set in Chicago, where Mark Manning was a highly regarded reporter for the Chicago Journal. It took me so long to get that first book published that by the time the first book was in print, I had long left Chicago and had moved to Wisconsin, Kenosha, Wisconsin, to be exact. By the time I had finished drafting the second Mark Manning novel, I thought, I really can't continue this. I need to, you know, I need to come up with a setting that I can write more authoritatively about, because the whole day-to-day Chicago thing was gone. It wasn't there anymore. So I decided that I would come up with a fictitious setting, and just after tussling around with names and locations and so on, I decided it would be a small town located in central Wisconsin. I named it Dumont, and because I was inventing it out of whole cloth, I could, of course, structure the town, the mental map of the town that only I know, but I could structure it in such a way to meet the evolving needs of the plots that were to follow. Whereas if I kept it in Chicago, I really couldn't invent too much, because it's a real city and people know it well.
Let's talk about some of your characters. Mr. Puss, I don't like saying that the person is an owner of an animal, but...
Right.
His caretaker, let's say, Mary Questman. Yes. Tell me about her.
Mary Questman. Well, I invented Mary when I wrote the original Mr. Puss short story. I mean, I kind of invented her to meet the needs of the plot. I knew about Mr. Puss, you know, already, and I just thought, you know, there's going to be a kindly old lady. I sort of saw her as the kindly old lady in the Tweety Pie cartoons, if you remember those. You know,
Granny.
Granny. Was that her name?
You know, yes, I don't think it was anything other than Granny.
and then once I had a visual image of her, she needed a name and she needed circumstances. And I don't recall the exact chain of events that made her a wealthy widow, but that's who she became.
And then we have Brody, who you talked about helping the local sheriff.
Right.
And he has a husband, Marson.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit more about them?
Yeah, actually, Brody and Marson were the principal characters in a collection of linked short stories that I wrote several years ago called Inside Dumont. I ended up with this collection of a dozen stories that introduced a lot of characters in a sense, each of the stories sort of acted as elaborate character sketches for me. And then, you know, later on, I realized, wow, there's a lot of fertile material there. And, you know, I can pick and choose from this freely now in terms of whatever the next book is going to be. And that was at the same time Mr. Puss was happening in my head. Mr. Puss does not appear in the collection of short stories, but Brody Norris does. Mm-hmm. And his husband, the architect Marson Miles, he's actually the linking character in all of the stories in Inside Dumont. In some of those stories, he is front and center and you're in his head. And in other stories, he's just passing through, but he's always there.
Well, you were talking about overlapping stories. So that actually brings me to the next character, reporter Glee Savage.
Oh, I love Glee. Thank you for bringing her up.
This isn't the first time we've seen Glee.
No. Glee was in all of the Mark Manning mysteries once the series moved to Dumont. So she was in there are seven Mark Manning mysteries. So she played an important role in the last five. She served as a features editor of the local paper, the Dumont Daily Register, and she worked for Mark Manning in the years when he ran that paper. And I had no doubt, you know, as I began to consider the possibilities for the Mr. Puss series, I knew it would be in Dumont. I knew that Brodie Norris was going to be the central character, and of course, the cat was going to be there. And I was also certain that many previous readers would recognize Dumont as having already been established in the Mark Manning series. So what I finally decided on was that Glee Savage would indeed appear, you know, prominently in the new series, and she's the only character from the old series who is in the Mr. Puss series. As you may have discovered in reading the second installment of Mr. Puss, titled Choir Master, out today, there are finally some references, specific references to Mark Manning. It's left as an open question as to what became of him. And then at the very end of this book, Choir Master, in fact, on the last page, there is an important clue regarding what the next novel in the series is going to be about.
And we won't go any further than that.
Yeah, we won't go further than that. But people who want to know more, will definitely find it in the third installment.
So I think it's great that you used her to tie these together with while still having separate stories.
Right, and it gives prior readers a sense of being anchored to the new series already. They know Glee, and she's such a memorable character. Also, I should mention that, you know, one of the reasons I decided to hold on to her and to hold on to this connection to the local paper, the Dumont Daily Register, is that I enjoy adding those epistolary elements to the novel. Those news clippings are an excellent, efficient way to handle certain elements of exposition to a story as you're moving along. You know, you reach a point where you just want to get the facts down, and it would be a terrible disservice to the reader to just, you know, do an exposition dump into the real narrative of the book. But then when you say, you know, he picked up the paper and he read this story and it reads like a news story and it's just the facts, it's really, I've found a great way to impart information in a believable way.
How is this different than the Mark Manning series?
Obviously, it's a whole different set of characters, except for Glee. And while the main character is a gay man who is involved in a relationship with another gay man, in fact, they're married, that's not a central focus of these stories the way it was in the Mark Manning stories. The first Mark Manning novel was sort of his coming out story, and then he committed to his lover, and then they sort of adopted a foster son. And, you know, and the aspects of their gay life were very, very central to the whole telling of those books. In the current series, Mr. Puss, that's all there, but it's treated much more matter-of-factly. I think society as a whole, and literary tastes more specifically, have become not only accepting of gay characters and gay main characters in books, but there's almost an expectation that this will be treated more matter-of-factly than it once had to be.
It's refreshing. It used to be every story seemed like it was a coming-out story. And right. The fact that you have a married couple that just happened to be two gay men that are married is very refreshing to me. And I appreciate that. Ace reporter Glee Savage. What would she tell me about Michael Kraft?
Ooh. She would tell you that I remind her somewhat of Mark Manning, and I remind her somewhat of Brodie Norris, both of whom she has been very close to. As the author in question, I can tell you that there's a little bit of me in every character I write, mm-hmm. but no one character is me.
I would say that's probably pretty common with most writers. There's always a little, little piece of us in each character.
That's right.
Sometimes we don't like to admit that. You have a diverse background. You've written 16 novels, three of which, as I said, were finalists in the Lambda Literary Awards. You're a playwright, a screenwriter. You've written some short stories. In what way has this diversity helped you in your writing?
I've found later life to be such a fertile time for allowing myself to explore all of these aspects of creating. As I was coming of age and say turning 30, that's when I made up my mind that I really wanted to take seriously this dream I had held for a long time to write a novel, not only write a novel, but have it published. That became sort of an obsessive thing for me. It took 12 years to get the first novel published. So it was published when I was 42. Then I was kind of on a roll. I was under contract for a number of years to produce murder mysteries on a yearly basis. And I did, and I enjoyed it. But both of those mystery series began to get stale. Both of those mystery series, I felt, had reached their logical conclusion. And I wanted to, I wanted to put a period on them, which mm-hmm. I did, which left me some time to rethink. And that was about the time that I was thinking of moving to California, thinking of going back to school, finishing an MFA, because I did not yet have a master's degree. And I'd always been into theater. That's reflected in a lot of the novels. And so I was trying my hand at playwriting. I was trying my hand at short stories. I was searching for what it was that I really wanted to do with the rest of my life. Lo and behold, I came back to that original calling, which is long-form fiction. It doesn't always have to be a murder mystery. It doesn't always have to be a gay murder mystery. But I really do find that my first love is in long-form fiction. It's a wonderful kind of project to wed for a while. You can't knock out a novel, or at least you shouldn't. It takes me, a year to produce a novel. And it's a very obsessive sort of procedure and a very obsessive period, especially the drafting period. After it's outlined and researched and ready to go, and it's time to put 100,000 words on paper or 70,000 words or whatever it's going to be, that is one of the most intensive kind of activities that I think anyone can engage in. And for me, once I'm into a draft, it is 7 days a week. It's not 8 hours a day, but mm-hmm. I find, I don't know about you, Brad, but I find that drafting, which is what most people think of as writing, when they think of an author at the keyboard, to me, that's drafting. I find that to be emotionally and physically exhausting. I mean, if I put in a good 3 hours, 4 at the max, I'm ready to quit, and I won't force myself to work longer than that each day.
And that's actually one of the interesting things about it being a writer is we have a love for writing. It's actually a passion, but it is exhausting and a lot of work. You really have to love it to do it.
People who have not done it, who have not tussled with a difficult sentence or a seemingly impossible transition, to get you from point A to point B in the narrative you're trying to construct, I mean, really, unless you've done it, you can't appreciate how difficult that is and what an exhausting mental process it is to make it work. When I wrote my first novel, that was before personal computers. And in fact, it was while I was still working at the Chicago Tribune, but I was living in Kenosha. So I was riding a train every day, commuting. And that added about 4 hours a day when I just was sitting there on a train with a briefcase in my lap. And I thought this would be a good time and a good way to put that time to use would be to finally write, literally, handwrite, that first novel that I wanted to tell. So it was a matter of drafting on the train every day in longhand, getting home at night, transcribing what I had written that day by typewriter and watching the pages pile up. And then, you know, after finally, once there was a first draft, you know, a second draft meant retyping the whole novel. I mean, there was no word processing. So, you know, revision was an ominous and scary process at the time because, you know, you could do it once, you could do it twice, but you didn't really want to get into it much beyond that because it meant retyping the novel each time. Well, of course, now with word processing everywhere, I mean, that changes everything. It is amazing how that has removed the barrier to revision. But my routine is I will start the writing day by doing a very close, tight edit of whatever I wrote the previous day. And that kind of gets me back into the story and gets my fingers moving on the keyboard. And then I will do my quota. I hate to use that term, but you know, I will reach the goal that I have set for myself for the next day's drafting. And of course I'm revising it as I go along. And then the next day it starts over.
The mechanics certainly has changed of how we write. Yeah. Talking about typewriter with word processors now. But you brought up earlier, you started your first draft in 1980, and it did take you 12 years, which is not uncommon for a first novel at all.
Right.
But emotionally, how was that period for you?
Very difficult. Not only did it take 12 years to get a first novel published, but along the way, there were 27 rejections. I kept them. I counted them. I took heart in that, you know, not all of those rejections were just form letters or form postcards in some cases. But there were enough instances when an editor would take the time to write a short letter and say, you know, there's a lot of good things happening here, but you might consider this or that. And I took advice like that to be gold. And I just kept revising. And so I think the old maxim that persistence pays, you know, really does have a certain kernel of truth to it. That said, persistence doesn't always pay, you know, but if you give up, you know that you've failed. But on the other hand, if you keep on trying, there is always that chance that you're going to make it. And I think I had a happy ending, or a happy beginning, as it were.
It sounds like you had both. And you know, I think for a new writer, it's important for them to know, you know, you get 27 rejection letters, and part of it may mean that you have to grow as a writer, but sometimes it's just a matter of timing. It just isn't the right book for that particular publisher at that time.
That's absolutely right.
So not every rejection letter is a rejection against you. If you take it personally, then you're going to have a really tough time, even though it's really hard not to take it personally.
Right. And I mean, and actually when the first Mark Manning book sold, that was a matter of being in the right place, the right time with a new agent who was, you know, had, you know, connections in that genre. And, you know, it was like, we're ready to go. And, and when I first connected with him, he said, do you think you could maybe, you know, work up very rough, like pitches for subsequent titles, and we could make this a series, and I think we can go out and get a 3-book deal. And I thought, he's crazy. You know, I've been struggling for years to get anyone just to look at, you know, at what I've been writing. Mm-hmm. And he thinks he's going to go out and sell 3 at once. And by golly, it took him 10 days to do it. And I was off and running with the first 3 Mark Manning books, with Kensington Books. Flight Dreams was the first Mark Manning, and Flight Dreams was the first gay novel published by Kensington, because they wanted onto that bandwagon, which was, you know, which was pretty hot in the late 80s.
How have you grown as a writer since back then?
Over the years, I feel I've grown as a writer in the same sense that I've grown as a person. For instance, when I began the Mark Manning series, he was not a particularly likable character. He was rather arrogant. He was rather self-assured. At the time, I thought that made him heroic, and I don't anymore. So, you know, the characters I write have changed significantly in that time because my own thinking has changed in so many ways. That's all you're going to get on that one.
That's fine. That's a perfectly good answer. You kind of talked about the first draft and that being so tough. What do you find is the hardest thing about writing?
hands down, what I find the toughest thing about writing a book is getting the idea for it in the first place. That element of inspiration, that's a commodity that you can't plan on. It's not like doing research. It's not like doing outlining. It's not like committing to sitting at the word processor 4 hours a day. You've got to have the idea, something that inspires you to take that idea and spin it into a story that's going to captivate a reader for 80 or 100,000 words. They are far and few between. And I know that when I'm between projects, that is the source of most of my angst. What is the next one? Where's that going to come from? And all I can do at a time like that is, I like to talk about raising my creative antenna and, just being ready to snag any idea that comes along. It may be a snippet of something I read or hear, or it may just, appear out of nowhere. But when it comes, I know it. And that's when sort of obsessive note-taking begins. I do go through a phase at the start of each book. You can't just flip a switch and make it happen.
Yeah, you can't just sit down at the keyboard and say, I am creative right now, and I'm beginning my day.
Yeah.
I wish it was that easy,
Right.
I find if you're like me, sometimes coming up with a new idea, I'm just staring at the wall. And then other times I'm walking down the street and it hits me like a brick in the side of the head. And, just to say, okay, here's my idea out of nowhere. It's very difficult.
And plus the fact you're sort of, it's not just, what jazzes me, but it's, what would jazz a reader? And so, I have to think that, readers are going to find this as exciting as I do. And conversely, I won't just write what I think readers are going to like. I have to be really enthralled with it.
Now, you had hinted earlier that choir master about Mr. Puss. So it sounds like that we can expect more of Mr. Puss in the future. What does the future hold for him that you can tell us?
Well, I know there's going to be a third installment because I've begun drafting it. It's outlined. It's ready to go. And then beyond that, I'm not sure. One thing that I am sure of, and this has me rather excited, some months ago, I got an email out of the blue from an editor who was putting together a new anthology that will be titled Palm Springs Noir. This will be published by Akashic Books in New York. And one of the things they are known for, one of their specialties, is this series of city noir books, anthologies. And it started, I think, with Brooklyn Noir, and there's Chicago Noir, and Los Angeles Noir, Las Vegas Noir. They have a very broad readership, and it's a great concept. They will settle on a city or an area and recruit a group of writers, usually 14, and each writer contributes a noir short story set in a different location in that city or area. I've written it. Noir is not my style. Not my style in terms of what I have done in the past. And I think for that reason, I just jumped at the chance. I thought this will be an exciting opportunity to try out something new. And I had an absolute ball with it.
Well, the book sounds exciting to me, being in Los Angeles and having spent a little time in Palm Springs.
But, I also love the irony of, doing noir in Palm Springs, which is 350 days of sunshine a year. And the whole concept of finding its darker, seedier side, just has a really wonderful, ironic twist built into it.
that it does. That's part of what's going to make it so interesting.
Yeah. It's not a gay anthology, but if we're talking Palm Springs, how can you avoid that? Why would you avoid it anyway? But my story, for instance, is my regular gay readership will not be disappointed in this one, but the entire anthology will not consist of gay stories. But I know of at least a couple other gay authors who are contributing to it.
Yeah, and for those that aren't familiar with Palm Springs today, it has grown into a very large gay community. Part of the reason is because San Francisco has just gotten outrageously expensive. Palm Springs is dramatically cheaper, and it's just a beautiful place to retire to or move to. So that is why I think you can find some great opportunity for some good gay stories and gay mysteries.
And also, it's such a unique setting. It's this paradise built in an oasis. It is a desert. It's surrounded by mountains. I mean, it just, a totally beautiful landscape that lends itself to, lush description. And I don't hesitate to go that route.
Yeah, well, I'm a big fan of mid-century modern furniture and homes. So I'm in heaven. Yeah. I'm in heaven when I'm in Palm Springs. So I have a question that I have that I will ask. Questions that writers hate. So give me a second here and we'll spin the wheel. Okay, here's the question I have for you. I hear there's big money in erotica. Why don't you write that?
Actually, the first series, the Mark Manning series, has a lot of erotic material to it. It sort of facetiously named my subgenre as being gay erotic cozy. I really had a lot of explicit erotic material throughout the Mark Manning series. It sold well, I think. I hope not solely because of that. I don't think so. So the short answer is there really isn't big money in erotica, at least not for most of us. But on the other hand, I have written it, but I'm not doing it now.
Well, I think there's a big difference between having erotic scenes or erotica within a novel and having a novel that is designated as an erotic novel.
Absolutely.
There's a very big difference, in my opinion. So for our listeners, if they want to reach you or purchase your books, what is the best way for them to do that?
The best way to do that is to go to my website. It's very easy to find. It's michaelcraft.com, Kraft with a C, michaelcraft.com. Right on the homepage, you'll find everything you need to know about the new book, how to order it. It's available now in hardcover, paperback, and ebook. So, whatever your reading preference is, there is an edition to suit your needs. Also from from my website, you can email me if anyone would like to, like to discuss any of this further, or anyone who wants to connect with me on Facebook can find me there.
So it's actually one easy place to find you and your books, michaelcraft.com. That makes it nice and convenient. I do want to thank you for your time. I'm very excited that you were the person that was here for my premiere episode.
And I'm just delighted and honored, Brad, to do this with you. I think it bodes well for both of us. We both have excellent taste.
I will agree with you. So thank you very much for your time, Michael.
My pleasure.
If you have an idea to help improve the show or would just like to make a comment, go to our website, gaymysteryauthors.com. Click the link for contact. You'll find a number that you can call and leave a message, or you can just fill out the contact form. We look forward to hearing from you.
Go to our website, gaymysteryauthors.com, for links to subscribe on your favorite podcast applications so you don't miss a single episode. You'll also find transcripts of this and other shows. We're here every week. Thank you for listening.